Hello and thank you for downloading Sporting Witness from the BBC World Service with me, Simon Watts. As this year's Wimbledon gets underway, we're going back to the 1930s and the story of Fred Perry, the most successful British tennis player in history.
Well, hello there and how are you? I suppose the thing to do is to talk tennis. Otherwise, I don't see any other reason why you might want to talk to me.
That's the voice from the BBC archives of the legendary Fred Perry. In his heyday, one of the most famous sportsmen in the world, gallant escort to a series of Hollywood actresses and three times winner of Wimbledon.
Crawford drives into the net and Perry has saved another point.
Perry's first victory came in July 1934 when he defeated Jack Crawford of Australia.
I was lucky playing Crawford in the final, actually, because I had had a couple of previous wins over him, you know, in the last 6 months. I can't say that I knew I was going to win Wimbledon, no. I was hopeful.
Set and match point to Perry.
I had reached match point. Having gone from 3-1 in the first set, I hit one of those streaks and won 12 games in a row. And Crawford served, they call a foot fault. And the second serve was a double fault.
Game and set and match to Perry.
As is so often the case, the Wimbledon crowd have been waiting decades for a home victory, so there were enthusiastic celebrations.
That noise you hear is all the crowd standing up and cheering Perry as he leaves the court.
There was a great patriotic sort of fervour that swept all over the centre court. It really was.
Veteran British tennis player and BBC commentator Dan Maskell speaking in the 1960s.
I remember that I became rather emotional and I suddenly found my eyes misting up. It was a tremendous moment, and as Fred walked off the court with his rackets falling from under his arm, he touched me on the shoulder, I remember, and he had a tear or two, I think, in his eye.
As we walked off, behind the barrier, they had brought my father down from the stand, and he was crying. And I remember getting into the dressing room, and the ritual was that I would the bath would be ready, and I'd soak for about 15 or 20 minutes before I sort of showed up again. And it wasn't really until that time that I really realised sort of what had happened, that I had actually won the thing.
But as Fred Perry soaked in his victory bath, there was an incident he never forgot. One of Britain's top tennis officials came into the Wimbledon dressing room not to congratulate the winner, but to commiserate with the Australian loser.
I heard this voice of a committee man. I knew him. I remember him coming in with it must have been a bottle of champagne, because he went to Jack Crawford and he said, "Well, Jack," he said, "sorry you lost. This is, have a bottle of champagne. This is one time the better man did not win." And it was something that stuck in my craw.
That attitude was typical of many in the British tennis establishment at that time. Tennis was a sport for the rich and privileged. Fred Perry was working class from the north of England and the son of a Labour Party politician. He was not, they believed, a gentleman.
I was the first, more or less, non-old-school Thai person who represented his country. I hadn't been to Oxford and Cambridge, and my accent was certainly very different from theirs. But the point was, I could beat them. It was very much, "I'll show you, Charlie," because I hated to lose. You show me a good loser and I'll show you someone who's never going to win.
Fred Perry didn't go to a boarding school with tennis courts and vast playing fields. It was only when his family moved to London that he discovered sport. First table tennis and then tennis itself.
We went down for a holiday to Eastbourne, Devonshire Park, and I looked through the fence and I'd seen all these cars, these huge cars outside, and I looked through the fence and I saw these people all dressed in white chasing a silly little ball around on the grass. And I went back and I asked my father, I said, "Well, what is this particular game?" And he said, "Well, that's tennis, that's lawn tennis." He said, "I have a racket." So I said, "Well, now, I'd like to play this game if I can. I think I'm interested in it, I'd like to play it." So he said, "Well, I'll give you the racket." And I think from that day on, I practically lived on a tennis court.
Driven by his hatred of losing, Perry took tennis more seriously than his more gentlemanly rivals. He practiced religiously, often up against the wall of his house. And in the winter, he built up his endurance by training with Arsenal Football Club.
Wimbledon again, the greatest lawn tennis tournament in the world. Perry is in grand form. He takes Renville's service with ease and keeps his opponent on the run with smashing cross-court drives.
Fred Perry won Wimbledon again in 1935 and 36, and also led Britain to Davis Cup success. As fellow players Fred Hughes and Bunny Austin recalled, he was easily the best in the world.
When we played in Australia, he played the final of the men's singles. And then we went on and played the final of the men's doubles after a cup of tea. And he was going stronger at the end of that than he was when he started the afternoon.
He had phenomenal stamina.
He never had a sprain, he never had as much as a common cold.
And he always took great care of himself. He was very disciplined in what he ate. He didn't drink, he pretended to smoke a pipe, which he actually didn't smoke.
Yes, there was never any tobacco in the pipe, but he thought he looked good when the photographers were around. He loved to have his pipe.
Fred Perry became so famous that he began receiving lucrative offers to make films and adverts in America. But tennis was still a strictly amateur sport. Not only was there no prize money, even profiting indirectly from the game was banned. So Perry took a very difficult decision.
I didn't really want to turn pro, but I had an offer to make pictures for RKA Studio, two pictures a year on a two-year deal for money I'd never even dreamed existed. I didn't have to play tennis. I would probably have to open the door and say, "Good morning, madam." You know, Her Royal Highness is not in. And the International Federation said, "No way, because they're not paying you because you can act. They're paying you because you're a tennis player, you'll be a pro."
Turning professional meant Fred Perry couldn't play Wimbledon or the other majors again, and even his memberships were revoked by the world's leading tennis clubs. But he continued to play in exhibition matches and enjoyed his new life in Hollywood as a business partner of a former American world number one.
We lived in Beverly Hills, and Vines and I, Ellsworth Vines and I, we bought into the existing Beverly Hills Tennis Club and rebuilt it. And we had 125 members. And the restriction was that they had to be in motion pictures. And the opening day, I remember it very distinctly, the exhibition match was a British team against an American team. The Americans represented by Ellsworth Vines and Groucho Marx, and the British represented by myself and Charlie Chaplin. The dinner dance that night, which was a very, very posh affair, the music was provided by Benny Goodman and his quintet, because he was also a member of the club. That was the kind of club it was.
After retirement, Fred Perry founded the clothing company that still bears his name. And eventually he was welcomed back by Wimbledon, which in 1984 erected a statue to the only three-time British champion.
I still don't know how I feel about it. When I see it, it scares me. I don't know if I feel small or insignificant against it, or how the hell did this happen? Just nonplusses me that they should have done this. I've always had a love affair with Wimbledon. Probably the greatest love affair of my life has been Wimbledon. And ever since the very first day I walked in as a junior, anywhere I went in the world, I would compare what I saw on the tennis grounds to Wimbledon. And they always came second.
Fred Perry died in 1995. After his last victory, Britain had to wait another 77 years before Andy Murray became the next British Wimbledon champion in 2013. That edition of Sporting Witness was written and presented by me, Simon Watts.